Well, good afternoon, Juno. It's just right on 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. Pat Moore, your host today for Juno Afternoon. And we have a wonderful lineup of guests this afternoon. Lanny Leary is here in town, and she's going to be giving a talk tonight at the Centennial Hall. We'll be talking to her about that. Some folks are coming in who are going to do a UAS Evening at Eagan presentation on the Mendenhall outburst floods that we've had, two of them now. And it's Recovery Month, so the folks who are doing the Swing into Recovery dance will be here. And Pastor Elba Dog of Senegal, who is visiting and as part of a multi-year partnership with Chapel by the Lake, will be joining us. Weather looks wonderful, doesn't it? Amazing weather, okay? And what's happening is that it's going to stay this way tomorrow and should stay this way through tomorrow night. And then Sunday, of course, it's going to look more like Juneau with a little bit of rain.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A long-awaited inquiry into the death of a five-year-old at a Manitoba First Nation in 2005 recently got underway. But as Dan Karpinchuk reports, it was bogged down again.
The Manitoba Appeal Court has halted proceedings in the Phoenix Sinclair inquiry because of an issue involving access to transcripts of interviews of potential witnesses. In August, Child and Family Services authorities requested access to the manuscripts, but the head of the inquiry refused. The appeal court was asked to review that decision. It's estimated the transcripts amount to 10,000 pages. The inquiry was called to look into the circumstances surrounding the tragic death of the little girl on the Fisher River First Nation in 2005. It will also look at how the child welfare system failed Phoenix Sinclair. Derek Nepinak is the Grand Chief of the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs.
There's going to be a lot of finger pointing. You know, there's going to be a lot of people blaming one system over another, and I think at the end of the day, we're focused more on empowering our communities, empowering our families once again, as opposed to the failures of systems and functions.
Sinclair had been neglected and repeatedly abused by her biological mother and her stepfather. She had been taken away by child services at least twice, but then returned to her mother. She was killed on the reserve in June of 2005, but her body wasn't found until 9 months later, wrapped in plastic in an unmarked grave. Her mother and stepfather were convicted in 2008 of first-degree murder in connection with her death. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A South Dakota hospital has filed suit against the Indian Health Service over money. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
Leaders of the Bennett County Hospital in Martin, South Dakota, allege the Indian Health Service doesn't pay its bills. The hospital is located on non-tribal land between the Rosebud and Pine Ridge Indian reservations. The lawsuit against IHS seeks $1.65 million for care given to members of the Oglala Sioux tribe. That figure is the difference between payments the hospital has received and more than $2 million in care given to tribal members. A bit more than a year ago, the hospital faced possible closure over funds the administrator said was owed by IHS. At that time, the director of the Aberdeen, South Dakota office of IHS said some payments don't meet Indian Health Service guidelines and the facility would not be reimbursed. Bennett County Hospital sees about 200 patients a month in its emergency room, about 80% of them tribal members. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
Voter rights advocacy groups are calling restrictions on voting rights a state of emergency. Tristan Autone has more.
A broad coalition of groups representing everything from civil rights to faith-based organizations, including the NAACP, National Urban League, and National Congress of American Indians, say that while it's not only important to get voters to the polls, it's more important to make sure their votes count. National Congress of American Indians Executive Director Jacqueline Peta says one of the biggest issues being watched now is voter ID. What's acceptable, what isn't, and what's true or misinformation. She says in Indian country, questions about whether tribal IDs are acceptable forms of identification are one example of problems Native voters face now. And she says that debate and confusion is causing concern.
The whole debate causes confusion. And so when members are confused, it's another reason why not to go to the polls. And that's why it's so important for us to get the information out there early, let people be really aware of what are the requirements in their areas so that every vote can count.
According to PETA, double-checking your voter registration status is crucial, as well as knowing what your state's ID rules are, what precinct you should report to, and exact dates for when mail-in ballots will be accepted. For National Native News, I'm Tristan Autone.
J. During this month in 1956, the federal government began restoring tribal ownership of a large number of scattered lots on the Flathead Reservation in Montana to the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
About 5 minutes, almost 6 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, and my two guests in the studio with me here are, I mispronounced her name during the introduction, but it's Lonnie Leary and Hal Geiger. Lonnie just finished a book on the grieving process called No One Has to Die Alone, and she'll be giving a talk tonight at Centennial Hall starting at 7 o'clock. Welcome to Juneau.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and Hal is here as a representative of the Juneau End of Life Foundation, right?
Right. I've been on the board for a few years.
Okay.
And so, we're sponsoring tonight's talk.
Yeah. So before we get to Lonnie, can you tell us a little bit about End of Life?
Well, I can't remember the specific sequence in terms of the years, but one time we were hospice, and then Catholic Community Services took over hospice, and we became a foundation, and we've changed our name a couple of times. But right now we're focused on, well, we do such things as give out grants for training of hospice nurses and things like that, but we're also very focused on community education. And so we've been we have a speaker series, and this will be our fourth in the series. And we also have a book out that I think a lot of people are familiar with called When You're Not Here that was really kind of motivated by our president, Jenny Palmer's experience when her husband died. And we're continuing to try to just raise awareness about death, because every family is going to face it, whether it's imminent or whether it comes further out in the future. It's going to come. We're trying to get people to think about that before it's a crisis.
So, Lonnie, it was an early death in your family that sort of changed your life and set up the career for you.
It did. My mother died suddenly and unexpectedly when I was 13, and no one in my family had prepared me or my two younger brothers. We didn't talk about her illness. I had no idea that she was as ill as she was, and didn't have the language, certainly didn't see, have any models of people who were caring for someone who was dying. And so when she died, it was as though the rug was pulled out from under me. And even after she died, there was no explanation as to why she died, how she died. And it was decades, really, before I knew the full truth. And in the absence of information, real concrete information that adults should have provided, I made up my own story, and even as a 13-year-old, and I thought, smart enough, the story that I made up was much more tragic than the reality of her death, and it meant years of grief and shame and regret that I lived with. And
you actually blamed yourself.
I did blame myself, because my last recollection of my mother was her trying to reach out to me and tell me that she loved me, and I was a typical 13-year-old. And kind of tisked it off and rolled my eyes, I think, at her. And the next thing I knew, she was dead. And so my explanation of it was that she had died not knowing that her only daughter loved her, and therefore she had nothing to fight for. So, in my mind, it was my fault, and I was a bad daughter. That's what her death meant to me, that I was a bad daughter. And it really did wound me for decades. So I vowed that never again would I leave someone that I loved alone, abandoned, and I spent the rest of my life learning everything I could about death and dying and grief so that that would never happen to another one, but it also would never happen to me, that I would never have that level, that tyranny, really, of grief. And so I did take myself back to school and learned everything I could and worked with many different hospices and in hospitals with clients, patients who were dying, so that I could learn everything that I could, feeling that off into the future, hoping that my father would give me the opportunity to do it differently. And sure enough, he did. When he was 84 years old, he had end-stage cancer, and so I responded. I knew what to do, and by God, I was going to be at his bedside. So I was on the East Coast working and closed my private practice and closed my university classes that I was teaching on death and dying and flew home to Hawaii to be with him. And I know it made all the difference in the world to how he experienced his death. And it also changed how I experienced my grief. And so it was a healing on both sides. It was a gift on both ends. I know that I gave him the gift of my presence and skills and love. And he gave me the gift of allowing me into the most intimate times of his life and really shared that so closely.
Culturally, I think in the West, we have written death out.
Yes, we're very afraid of it.
In films or in stories, mm-hmm. it's very often something that is the children are sent from the room.
Absolutely.
And one adult is permitted to wait it out with the person, but it's really just kind of everyone sitting out in the hospital waiting room and then having the physician come out and
right.
shake their head.
Actually, it would be a lucky thing if there is one person waiting it out with the person who's dying. Oftentimes I see that role abdicated even to physicians or nurses, and even they are uncomfortable with the process. So many people in our culture think of death as a failure, and it's shameful. As though, I hear this often, that death is interpreted to mean that you have abandoned me or you have failed. And I'll hear people say, well, he just didn't pray hard enough, or he didn't work his program hard enough, or all kinds of, you know, it's not as though death isn't bad enough, but now we have to blame the person who's dying. And so we don't see the inevitability, as Hal said, that all of us are going to die. It is part of the life cycle. Let's make it natural. Let's make it okay. And let's do it well. Let's do it differently than our culture does it.
So in talks that you've done in the past, you've listed three things that we can do for people who are dying.
Yes, tonight I really want to leave people with a tool belt. I really want them to walk out of the hall tonight with a tool belt of very concrete things that they can do, because while it's not easy to be with people who are dying, there are definite practical interventions and responses that we can learn. These are skills that we can learn. And it is the hundreds and hundreds of patients who have allowed me to be with them that have taught me what is important, and I want to pass those things on. And I know that once people learn these skills, they can respond and they will respond, and it will change the landscape, not just of dying, but of living. Because if we can lean in to the reality of death, we live so much more freely.
Who do you want tonight? Who would you like to look out at the audience at Centennial and see?
I want to speak to the people of Juneau who are aging, and I hope will begin to think about these important choices and decisions that they can communicate. I want to speak to the people who are ill, and I want to speak to the people who are dying, who have received that terminal diagnosis. I also want to speak to their caregivers and family members to really empower them and give them the skills so that they can be with their loved ones right up to the last breath. And I want to speak to children. I want to let children know that it's okay to grieve. It's okay to be present with other people who are dying, that they're not going to catch it from them. And that children, as children, they too can make a big difference and give the gift of their presence to their loved ones as they're dying. I really know that if we die differently, if we die well, that it will impact the entire community of Juneau.
A lot of what has driven your career was an incident that happened to you when you were, I think, 29, and you had a near-death experience?
I did. It was an accident, and I went into anaphylactic shock, and it That was the second experience of my life that really changed the course of my life. The first was my mother's death, and I spent 15 years after that feeling every single day that I wish I could have talked to her and asked her questions and had her guidance in my life. And then 15 years later, when I was 28 and a half, I did have this experience in which I died, and I went into the tunnel that has been documented over 40 million times. And my mother was there to greet me.
Hmm.
And she was whole and healthy and vibrant and beautiful. And we communicated. And what I knew and still know with every fiber of my being is that death is a healing, that in death people are healed, but also that we will be greeted by loved ones who have predeceased us, and that it's all okay. In this experience, I had no fear. I had no anxiety. Everything was okay. And the message of that that I brought back, I do believe is comforting. And I hear from so many people who are dying and have had that experience of seeing a loved one who had died before them. We need to validate those experiences instead of dismiss them, because it is comforting.
Lonnie, your talk begins tonight at 7 o'clock. You're in Centennial Hall.
I
hope we have a big crowd. There's no charge for the talk.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope a lot of people come out to hear your message.
Thank you.
Well, thanks a lot for having us.
Yeah, thank you. It's 18 minutes after 3 o'clock and almost 19 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. We're in the middle of Juneau afternoon. My next two guests are here to tell us about a totally unpronounceable phenomenon. We've had two of these incidents where basically the Mendenhall Glacier has built a little lake inside itself and then dumped the water out and raised the levels of the rivers around Juneau to the point where we actually have had some flooding on the Back Loop Road. With me are Aaron Hood, who is a graduate of Colorado, and Jason Amundsen, who is a graduate of UAF. Both of them are members of the UAS faculty now, and they're both working on the Mendenhall outburst flood and plan to do a presentation tonight up on campus about that. Hi, guys.
How's it going?
Well, pretty good. So tell us about, let me try it, Jökulsá.
So Jökulsárlón, that's an Icelandic word,
right.
Actually means glacier leap or something like that.
Okay.
And English, we usually just call it an outburst flood because it's a lot easier to pronounce.
Yeah.
And so there's several different types of outburst
floods.
This
is Jason speaking.
Several different types of outburst floods that occur, different types of glaciers. And usually it's just some sort of basin of water that pools up and ends up draining beneath the glacier catastrophically.
So the last one of these that happened wasn't as big as the first one. The first one we actually had water up over the park, the trails on the backside of the road, and it was up under the bridge to a dramatic extent. There was quite a little traffic jam out on the back loop bridge of people photographing the river and like that.
Yeah, that's right. It didn't. This year was about half what we had.
Yeah, what was the difference?
Last year, it was the peak stream flow in 2011 was close to 16,400 CFS on the Mendenhall River cubic feet per second, and then it was only about 8,800 or so. So it was a little over half in terms of what the peak flow was that we saw this year compared to last year.
Do we have a clue as to why there was a big difference?
Well, one of the main reasons is that there was just less water in the basin this year, and we know that from kind of observing the high water marks in Suicide Basin where the outburst flood is originating. The flood also occurred several weeks earlier. It was a colder summer, so there's a number of possible reasons, but probably the most important thing was just less water stored up in the basin there before it released.
Is there action we need to take here?
That's what we're trying to figure out.
Other than raise the houses up, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, that's. So we're sort of doing two things right now. One is to just put a monitoring system in place, so we at least have some sort of benchmark that we know if the Suicide Basin starts to drain, we have an idea of how much water is going to come out. So that's one thing. The other thing we're doing is to just try and figure out how the system works. And that's something that's going to take a lot more time to figure out, and it's difficult to assess, I guess, with what we have so far. But what we can do is to try to get an idea of how much water can be stored up in Suicide Basin, and kind of do a worst case scenario. I don't know if we're at the point yet that we need to take action, but definitely need to be aware that these things could and likely will continue to happen.
To what extent are students involved in this process?
We've had a few students that have worked on this project. I mean, in terms of the field work components, mm-hmm. we had a student, Jamie Pierce, who has been kind of instrumental in helping to build the monitoring station that we had up there, using a lot of the equipment. We've had some other student field assistants that have worked on the project and some of the data collection that Jason's working on. So that's a big component for us, is trying to get students involved in the research and get them out in the field and get them that kind of experience, the hands-on experience that's good for them in terms of employment opportunities afterwards, basically.
This is a little unusual in that if we had a graduate school here, there'd probably be a scad of graduate students who would be working on this project, but we're all undergraduate in your things, right? There's not a master's degree program going on out at UAS in any of the fields that you teach in.
Yeah, that's correct.
So students really have an opportunity here that they may not get at another institution.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, I mean, definitely undergraduate students have some great opportunities here. We do have some graduate students and postdoctoral scholars through UAF or through UAS if it's a postdoc, but a lot of the research kind of effort is being done by undergraduates in conjunction with us, and so it is a really great opportunity for them.
Jason, you got your degree out of UAF, and then you went, I think, to Chicago for a postdoctoral fellowship?
Yeah, that's right. I was in Fairbanks for 7 or 8 years, and then was in Chicago for 1 year, and then this job opened up and came back to Alaska the first chance I had.
What was the Chicago opportunity?
There was a postdoc at University of Chicago, and it was totally unrelated. I mean, it was a project on glaciers, but totally unrelated to this sort of thing. We were thinking more about ice shelf collapse, big ice shelves breaking apart.
And Aaron, you have a really impressive list of publications. Are you publishing on the outburst as well?
Not really. I mean, that's not my research area. It's actually more in hydrology and biogeochemistry. And so I'm interested in this from a hydrology standpoint and from understanding sort of the dynamics of the river, and also just from sort of a community service aspect. We're very interested in developing a monitoring system that can help us to have some warning about this and also some predictive capacity, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight in terms of, you know, what were we able to do this last summer in terms of monitoring, which was a little bit, and then, you know, what kind of system do we hope to build to address the monitoring sort of management emergency questions, and then also, as Jason mentioned, address questions about how the system fundamentally works, and that's kind of a longer-term thing that Jason will be talking about. So,
who are you thinking ought to be in your audience tonight?
Who
would you like to be sitting out there listening to you?
Everyone. I mean,
that's not a fair answer.
It's the glacier. It's more exciting than whales and anything else you can think of. So, I mean, I think anyone who lives in the valley should be interested in this.
Yeah.
For sure. It's the your own local natural hazard. Anyone who's interested in sort of glacier dynamics, as you mentioned before, there was a lot of interest the year of the big flood just to see all the people out on the bridge standing there and looking at the floodwaters. I know Tom Matisse at the city was telling people, don't go out and stand on the bridge during the flood. But if you have that interest and you were out there standing on the bridge, you should come to our talk and hear more about it.
So you're up at 7 p.m., right?
Yes.
Okay. And you in the theater?
Egan Lecture Hall.
Large Egan Lecture Hall. Okay, yep. Good. And, of course, these are always free. This is Evening at Egan. I think you're the second program in the Evening at Egan series this year. I believe that's right. This is Friday nights. There's always, throughout the season, there's a program.
Yep.
Of course, not all of them are about our own local glacier and the exciting piece of ice that we have. I think, are we the only community in the United States with a glacier inside its city limits? I believe we may be.
It might be.
I'm think
not
so.
Sure. I don't know if there's any other universities in the world that have a glacier nearby.
Yeah, the Wired Glacier is part of its the listable resource as well. Anyway, 7 o'clock tonight, evening at Egan at the Egan Lecture Hall. Aaron Hood, Jason Almanson, and they're talking about the Mendenhall outburst floods. Thank you guys for coming down and alerting us to the possibilities here.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 21st of September, 2012. It's the birthday of Savonarola, Girolamo Savonarola, born in Ferrara, Italy, 1452, the great idealist who joined the Dominican monks, preached against the Medici family in Florence, preached against the corruption of the Catholic Church, which got him in trouble with the corrupt Pope Alexander VI. And at the age of 46, Savonarola was arrested, tortured, and executed by hanging, and his ashes scattered in the Arno River. It's the birthday of H.G. Wells, born Bromley, England, 1866. He had medical problems, thought he was dying, which prompted him to write Faster and Faster, and over a period of 3 years produced his three most famous books, The Time Machine, The Invisible Man, and The War of the Worlds. H.G. Wells, who said, "Every time I see an adult on a bicycle, I no longer despair for the future of the human race." It's the birthday of Leonard Cohen, born Montreal, 1934, started out as a poet, wrote a couple of novels, didn't do well, moved to this country to become a folk singer and songwriter. First album, Songs of Leonard Cohen, came out in 1967, was enormously successful. In 1984, his album, Various Positions, included his song Hallelujah, which has been covered by nearly 200 other singers. Latest album, Old Ideas, earlier this year. It's the birthday of Stephen King, Portland, Maine, 1947. When he was 10 years old, he went to the local theater to see a matinee of Earth versus the Flying Saucers, and the manager interrupted the movie to announce that the Soviet Union had launched Sputnik, and Stephen King said for the first time he saw a useful connection between the world of fantasy and the world of current events. And he set out to write horror stories, took a job teaching high school, which inspired him to write about a troubled teenage girl. He thought the story was worthless. He threw it out. His wife rescued it from the trash, thought it was promising, told him to keep at it, so he did, and Carrie was published in 1974. Stephen King, as prolific as ever, the eighth installment of his Dark Tower series came out last spring. Next book, due next year, a sequel to The Shining, currently at work on Joyland, a novel about a serial killer in an amusement park. And it was on this date in 1937, J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit was first published, a book that had begun with a line Tolkien wrote down, "In a hole in the ground there lived a hobbit," though he didn't know what that meant. Here's a poem for today by Mae Swenson, entitled "A Day Is Laid By." A day is laid by, it came to pass. Wind is drained from the willow, dusk interlaces the grass. Out of the husk of twilight emerges the moon. This the aftermath of jaded sunset, of noon, and the sirens of bees. Day and wrath are faded, now above the bars of lonely pastures loom the sacred stars. A poem by Mae Swenson, A Day Is Laid By, from the collection May Out West, published by Utah State University Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. iPad users can download the three most recent issues of Poetry Magazine, celebrating its centennial in 2012, at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Written by Holly Vanderhaar, edited by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's just coming up on 27 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. We are in the middle of Juneau afternoon. My next guest is a member of the Alaska Mental Health Board, and she's also part of the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. Terry Tibbett is here to talk to us about the ongoing activities of September being Recovery Month. And so far you've had two or three activities around, they're actually going on around the whole state and also in Juneau.
Sure, there's lots of things going on, and I just want to clarify, I'm a staff to the board, so I'm not a member of the board.
Okay.
I want that distinction is important. So anyway, so what we're doing, there's a committee of people all throughout Juneau that has been working for the last couple of months on planning and carrying out these different events that celebrate recovery from alcoholism, drug abuse, and or mental illness. And the coalition of community organizations and people and different things, individuals, all have come together every year, and we plan these different events. And so a few of them have passed us by already, and maybe we won't talk about those, but if we come back, that's fine. But coming up is the Swing into Recovery Swing Dance that's happening tonight at Rockwell downtown, and it's going to have a live swing dance jazz band. It's the band is called Swing But a Bing, and it's led by Robert Cohen, and everyone who knows Robert Cohen knows his expertise as a jazz musician, so it's going to be great swing music. And we have Daniel Martin, who is going to be teaching lessons, swing dance lessons. So people who want to do that and come and swing dance, it's going to be a real lively atmosphere. I assure you, it's for swing dance lovers.
Now we emphasize here that these are alcohol-free events, and the nice thing about that is that in order for someone to go to something like a swing dance, very often it's hard to do that without having somebody open the bar in the back of the room. So here's an opportunity to not have the bar open and be a problem and have a good time.
Exactly. And now, it raises endorphin levels, you know. It does make you feel really good. So it's a good replacement for drugs and alcohol, too.
So that starts at 8 o'clock, and Daniel is there throughout the evening to break in and give some lessons here and there and like that.
I think the plan is that he's going to give lessons from 7 to 8, like formal.
Okay.
They're going to stop the band, start the band. Kind of, it's going to be a real like that. And then after 8, everybody's just going to have fun and practice what you learned. And he'll be there. I'm sure if people have questions, he's all about that.
And this is up in that big area, that's the second floor of what was the old Elks Lodge, now called Rockwell.
Exactly.
It's a restaurant downstairs and like that.
Yeah, and the easiest way to describe where it is it's just one building down from the Baranoff Hotel. So it's separated from the Baranoff Hotel with an alley. So the building that's on the other side of the alley is the Rockwell building. So, I mean, I don't think it's called the Rockwell building, but Rockwell is in that building.
Yeah. Now, you also have a film festival series going on, and I think there's two showings this weekend on Saturday and Sunday. Saturday at 4 in the afternoon and Sunday at 2 in the afternoon. And this film is called Bill W.
Mm-hmm.
I heard Colette talking about this. She was on the show, I think, a couple of weeks ago, and she was talking about this series. And she gave this a rave review. Bill W. is the man who actually started Alcoholics Anonymous, and so this is a biographical film about him and the reasons that he started it and the reasons that he did the things he did. And the other thing that's in here is a lot of archival footage, so it's a real, as I understand it, well-produced documentary. I haven't seen the film myself, but Colette is a reliable judge of good filmmaking. So that's another opportunity, Saturday at 4 and Sunday at 2, to see Bill W. over at the Goldtown Theater.
Yep.
Now, you have one other event, I think, scheduled for the thing, and that is near the end of the month on Friday, September 28th. Next Friday, you have a poetry slam going on.
Exactly.
What's happening there?
Well, this is, I think, the sixth annual poetry. It's called the Recovery Poetry Slam, and it invites people to bring poems inspired by recovery or about recovery or whatever. And the whole intention is that people gather together and they tell they read their poems, and then there's sort of a competition where they kind of try to out-poet each other, you know. And so eventually there's a winner at the end of the night. There's a first, second, and third prize, and it's nominal, but it's something, and it's a lot of fun, apparently. I haven't gone. Oh, actually, I did go to the last one, but the people who go always say it's just a great, you know, people are up there with some really funny poems and some really serious poems and some really striking poems, and it's a very, very engaging evening for sure.
And Terry, you've had two other events prior to this. On Sunday, the 9th of September, was FASD Awareness Day throughout the state, and there was a recovery walk on the 15th. How has the public response been?
It's been good. I mean, it's steady, I guess. It's consistent. People are participating. They're coming to the events that are being held. Definitely the Bill W., the documentary that showed at Goldtown last Wednesday was sold. I mean, not sold out. I think it was standing room only. I mean, every seat was taken. Mm. So, and we hope with the swing dance tonight, we're going to also have a good turnout. But, you know, we did the FASD Awareness Day tents tables all around the state. The alcohol industry CHAR helped work with a lot of nonprofit agencies, including the Alaska FASD Partnership and some other partners, and everyone band together, and we were able to get table tents about, watching out for drinking alcohol during pregnancy on about 800 tables statewide. And Juno participated hugely with the Juno Partnerships for Families and Children organization, donating their time to put the table tents on about 20 restaurants in Juno. So it was a real success. So there was a lot of turnout. A lot of people saw those table tents on that day, and that was a good thing. So, yeah, there's been, I'd say there's, steady, consistent, good, positive response to Recovery Month events this month.
What would you say is the overall goal of having a month dedicated to recovery?
I think just to raise awareness. I think, just to have a reason to remember it, because if things fall off the map, don't get attention, they don't often get worked with and dealt with. So sometimes it's good to just keep people aware that there's issues going on, and don't forget there's people in recovery. Don't forget there's providers out there helping people in recovery, and a bunch of people kind of trying to deal with this situation. And it's just a time to remember and be aware of it, I guess.
Tonight, 7 o'clock, swing dance lessons, starting at 8 o'clock, a swing dance with Swing Bada Bing at Rockwell, upstairs in the old Elks Club area, alcohol-free swing dance as part of Recovery Month. And then Saturday and Sunday, Bill W. at the Gold Town, and the 28th, start writing poetry because you're going to be on stage on the 28th. Thank you so much.
Positive black soil model, say she been at over style.
One big female, man, give some my love. But that plain a hell, man, hold my love. Best thing in your way, no one magi now. See, like saga hamne, but the yaw di cane. Best thing in your way, man, give some my love. That may not happen. Man, follow my love. Best thing in your way. No one magi now. See like saga.
The music is from Senegal, and in a few moments we're going to have a guest from Senegal. But for the moment here, Darren Snyder and a friend are here to talk about a program that's coming up. What's up, guys?
Well, we are very fortunate in Juneau right now to have Greg Schweitzer, who has come to town to teach adults and youth about the 4-H robotics program. And so these are the little robots that are kind of made famous here locally with the First Lego League and the Juneau Economic Development Council, with the whole contest they do about that. And, well, we use those same robots, the NXT robots, to teach kids about robotics, teach them how to program them. And tomorrow we are doing a full-day training that Greg is leading.
So, and this is a competition for what age of students?
This is a training, so, having a friendly competition may be part of it tomorrow, but mostly it's to teach adults and youth how to program these things, and it's for ages about 9 on up. And we do want to have an adult with the youth, so you can come tomorrow morning to the Bill Ray Center. And that is the UAS building right downtown. Mm-hmm. It's at 1108 F Street. So that's the Bill Ray Center.
And come
there at 9 a.m. And we're in one of the rooms downstairs, room 154. And you can just come there at 9 o'clock. And we're asking a $20 registration fee. That will help pay for some of the expenses of flights and such. It's a pay-as-you-can as well, so we don't want anybody to be priced out. So tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., and this is, again, for this the robotics training, and any adults and youth who are interested can come and learn about this robotics training.
Greg, what can you get one of these robots to do?
Gosh, we have some really fun projects tomorrow. Our first one is to rescue a moose
that's stranded on an island. And so you build a robot and a special arm that runs out there, picks up the moose, and brings it back home safely. And that's just to get the basics. You build the robot from scratch and then the arm from scratch, and you program it to do this. And then we end up with a final competition where we build little sumo wrestling robots. And the goal with these robots is to push the other robots out of the ring. And you get to make any crazy attachment on the robot you want to make your, to try and hedge your bets towards winning the thing. And it's really fun. It builds a lot of, in one day, kids are starting off from scratch, and they're building robots and programming robots to do things they couldn't imagine doing before.
Okay. The nicest thing about this is those robots are fairly expensive toys, so you're providing the equipment.
Yes, we are. The robots and the a laptop to help interface with it as well. And another nice thing is that some are going to be available for us soon here for our 4-H Robotics Club to use. So you don't have to invest in it yourself. You can just join the 4-H Robotics Club, and we can have you doing this and enjoying it.
9 o'clock tomorrow morning, Bill Ray Center, Greg Schweitzer in town to teach a course in 4-H robotics with Lego robots and how to program them and how to make them do wonderful, interesting things. Mm-hmm. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Pat.
Thank you.
Good to know. Positive Black Soul Modelo CG Bernard Over Style. That plain a hell, man, holy man, a one. Best thing in your way, no one may be now. See, like Saga Hamne, but the Yawdi can. Best thing in your way, man, get a man, a one. But that plain a hell, man, holy man, a one.
Before 4 o'clock. I have two guests in the studio, and one of them has traveled some distance to be on our show today. With me are the pastor of,
Chapel by the Lake.
Chapel by the Lake, thank you. And I didn't get your name before we started this thing. I don't have it.
Yeah, my name is Douglas Dye, Doug Dye.
Okay, Doug Dye, who is the chapel at Chapel
pastor
by the Lake
chapel.
Pastor.
Uh-huh.
And Elwa Doug of Senegal, who is with is it Kerjam? Is that the way you say it?
Yes, that is Kerjam, which means house of peace in Wolof. That's local Senegalese, you know, 80% of the population speak Wolof.
Uh-huh. Yep. There's a long-standing relationship, I believe, between Chapel by the Lake and Pastor Doug. Is that
yes, we created a relationship with ministries in Senegal started in 2002, so 10 years now. And much of that has been with Elwa and ministries and organizations he's been involved with. Not just the Kerjam Church, but before that, World Vision as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, have you been to Juneau before?
This is my very first time coming to Juneau. It was not only exciting, but great. Everything is beautiful. This is my very first time to see the snow, you know. So, I mean, I
did you take
my
him out to the glacier?
Well, did you go to the glacier today?
Oh, yes, sure. Today we went to that, how do you call it? Is it Saint Martin?
Oh, no, Saint Therese. Shrine.
Yes, just went toward the sea, and I mean, just see the things. And I've seen the dolphin, you know, coming close. Beautiful. Mm-hmm. And we have a time to just pray, thank the Lord for all these beautiful things he does, you know, how diversity he is, you know. I mean, great.
I have a priest friend who once said that he was taught that God speaks to us through nature. And when he arrived in Alaska, he said he realized that God was shouting at him.
Oh, great.
So
that's right.
that's our kind. But Senegal is right in the middle of a lot of tension areas. You have an mm-hmm. ongoing thing to the south of you in a country which I'm not sure I can pronounce the name of, but it's
Ziguinchor.
Yeah.
Casamance. Yeah.
Yes, and then your neighbors with Mali, and you guys share a language, and Mauritania is mm-hmm. just to the north of your mm-hmm. country, to the north and to the east.
Actually, it's pretty tense, but we really thank the Lord that this thing has not just come to us. But definitely we are affected because, you know, we share the same border, you know, just like you say, the very people, ethnic group that are in both sides of the different frontier. So in one way or the other, the same family have been affected in both sides. Mm-hmm. But it just happened. God has really showed favor. Senegal is quite stable, though we have had a pre-election tension and everybody was fearing that, finally it will spark also in Senegal. But we thank God with a lot of prayer, I think, you know, people that have been involved praying here and then. And the election went on smoothly, though recently with the turmoil in Mali, and most recently in the Gambia,
all
these things have been somewhat affecting, you know.
The Gambia kind of slices your nation in half,
yes,
right?
Yes, Gambia is almost the mouth of Senegal,
yeah,
so
yeah.
to say.
Yeah. The country, because of the Gambia, it's shaped like the letter G.
Exactly,
And Gambia sticks in the middle of it.
Yeah.
Small. Is it separated geographically? Is there like mountains or something that causes?
No, you can just write throughout. So if you are going to the southern part of Senegal, you'll cross the whole Gambia to go inside the country.
So I was wondering if maybe that strange shape, but that's really just territorial. It's political.
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
Political. Yeah.
Okay. And you have a new president now, Macky Sall.
Macky Sall, yes.
Sall, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And he ran on a platform that was to limit the number of terms that a president could serve
exactly.
and shorten the term, I
just
think.
Just 5 years renewed once, and that's it.
So
and
this is
before I came, they just vote a new law to cancel the Senate, mm-hmm. because it was kind of budgetivore. It had a lot of money put into it. So they want to reverse that money to help the people in the flood. You know, Senegal have been flooded. This is about 2-3 weeks now.
Right.
So we have flood everywhere. So they want to use that money to help relocate the people that are victims of that thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the middle of all this, in recent years, you've built a church.
Yes.
And which you finished, I think, in 2005.
In 2005, we dedicated it to the Lord. It was through the partnership with the Chicago Christian Life Center, with Pastor Jerry McQuay. They have really been along with us and have really helped, you know. Because in Dakar, I was sharing with Dave, we have very few churches that have their own property. I think in Dakar, we are not up to 10 churches that can really say that this is our property.
Yeah. Now, Pastor, you've taken, I think, a tour, or people from your church have gone over to Senegal and been guests.
Right. I've been there twice with what we call vision trips to Senegal twice. And but our church has gone 8 times. The first time was 2002. We took a group, and we've taken groups over the years, a total of 8 groups. The last time we went was January of 2011, which is when I met Elwa. And, you know, often it's just to sort of expand our vision, our understanding of what's going on there in terms of development, Christian development, that sort of thing. One time we took a medical team over there, mm-hmm. Some local medical folks, a pediatrician and some nurses, and were involved in health clinics and that kind of thing as well. So,
Pastor Doug, what will you do while you're here? What do you want to do in Juneau?
In Juneau, we have come to visit and to, you know, try to strengthen our bonds with Chapel by the Lake and share about our dream vision, you mm-hmm. know, together for the next 5 years, you know, see how we can consolidate what we have been doing in a holistic way. For example, clean water, primary health care, food security, education and literacy, economic development, and all these things with a cross-cutting team, which is discipleship and evangelism. So we are going to see in which way we can really consolidate the things that we have been doing. And also to raise more prayer support, you know, because I believe it's all about prayer. Prayer works, you know, and I believe that prayer is the key. If we have people behind that can really support what we are doing in prayer, you know, asking what is going on, and of course, giving to us what we are doing, we believe that we will build more autonomous, you know, communities. Mm-hmm. So this is part of my visit in Juneau, Alaska.
We started this partnership in 2002, and we see ourselves obviously in a long-term partnership with exactly. development and ministry and holistic ministry. With Elwha and others in Senegal. So, you know, we wanted to bring Elwha here so we could share him with our congregation, the community, and reignite our own vision for how we can be supportive of the exciting things that are happening there. So it's just good to kind of refresh our friendship.
I'm wondering what the relationship between your church and the government in mm-hmm. Senegal. Because in the United States, we are very careful to separate those two things. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how your government works.
In Senegal, it's also the same. Excuse me. Though it's true that the country is above 90% Muslim, but there is a guarantee in the constitution of Senegal is a lay country, you know, and there is a clear separation between the state and the church or any religious body, you know. We can freely worship God and promote your ideas either through writing, press, or film, or what have you. So, but we have a very good partnership. You know, the church has always been a vehicle that God has used to bless this community during this time of either turmoil, difficulty, and what have you. And the government looks to the church as a real partner, you know, in terms of healthcare, education, and helping people to find to be stabilized. At times they used to tell us, you have the message that can change the hearts, you know, so we definitely need you, you know, to play this role. So we are in very good terms. And this new leadership coming in with President Macky Sall is a very great, very open, you know. And as I go back home, next week we are going to welcome in Senegal the governing council of AEA. AEA is the Evangelical Body of Africa, the Association of Evangelicals in Africa. So we are going to have about 120 delegates coming to Dakar to strategize, to plan, to pray, you know, for the evangelical body of Christ in the continent. And Senegal is hosting it, just to say that we have very good, relationship and partnership with the government.
How does Senegal's attitude toward religion compare to the countries around you?
Oh, Senegal is a kind of more liberal. We have a folk Islam. It's nothing like anti-Greece, radicalism, no. Up till now, thank God for that, you know. People are very open. And in a family, you will easily find both Christian, Muslim, and animists, you know, living in a very same compound and without any problem. And Senegal has been a kind of champion in world religion, dialogue, you know. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, Pastor Elwha Doug, you're going to be here for how long?
I'm going to, it's just remained maybe
right.
3 days.
Yeah, you're not, no. You leave Monday night.
I'm leaving Monday night.
Way too soon. He's got business to do in Africa, back in Senegal, with this big conference with 50 African nations converging on Dakar.
Yes.
And Elwha is coordinating that. So,
are you preaching at chapel on Sunday?
Yes. By God's grace, I've been given the opportunity to speak to the three services.
Yes, he'll be preaching at our 8 o'clock service, our 9 o'clock service, and our 11:15 service. Yeah. And then, if we don't wear him out too much, he'll also be at church 6:30 in the evening to talk about Senegal, sort of expanding the conversation we're having here.
Uh-huh.
Wonderful. Well, yeah. We certainly welcome you to Juneau. We're very glad to have you among us.
Thank you.
And
very much.
We appreciate your bringing us these messages from Senegal.
Thank you.
Thank
indeed.
You. Thank you.
Old Dan and I, with throats burned dry and souls that cry for water,
water, water,
clear water,
water.
The nights are cool and I'm a fool, each star's a pool of water.
Writers in the Sky, they're coming up Monday night, 7 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. We broadcast on a set of translators throughout the area. In the Valley and Auk Bay, we're on K276 AF. That's on 103.1 in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM on 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Straits, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS. That's on 89.9. And in Juneau, we're on cable channel 871. Katie hosts on Monday. Tune in for Juneau Afternoon.